This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Kevin Wilson, writes novels about families, families where something extreme is happening. In his best-known novel, The Family Fang, the parents are performance artists who make their children be part of the act. In Wilson's new novel, Nothing to See Here, a 28-year-old single woman, Lillian, is asked to take care of two 10-year-old twins. She's warned that they have a unique affliction. When they are frightened or angry, they burst into flames. The flames don't damage the children, but the fire can spread and burn the people and things around them. The novel is partly inspired by how Kevin Wilson felt as a child when he couldn't control the terrifying images that flashed through his mind. When he was an adult, he was diagnosed with Tourette syndrome. In the novel, the person who asked Lillian to take care of the twins is Lillian's former prep school roommate, Madison. Lillian couldn't afford the tuition, but she had a scholarship. Madison was from a wealthy family and has since married Jasper, a senator on the verge of being nominated to serve as Secretary of State. The twins are children from his previous marriage. Their mother has just died, so the twins are coming to live with Jasper and Madison, who see these combustible children as a burden and a threat to Jasper's political career. Kevin Wilson, welcome to Fresh Air. So I'd like you to start with a reading where Lillian, for the first time, witnesses the children catching on fire. Place this section in context for us and describe, if you will, what sets the children off.
Sure. So Lillian has brought the two children, Bessie and Roland, to meet Jasper and Madison. And there's another man, Carl, who is a handler for the family, who's also there. And the children have been estranged from their father, Jasper, for several years, and simply the sight of him sort of agitates them and kind of starts off this process. Smoke started coming off the children, their cheap clothes now singed. "Oh," Madison said, and everyone was just standing there, not doing anything, while these children increased the intensity of the fire that was inside them. That's what it seemed like the fire was inside them. Children made a fire. And I knew it would get worse if something didn't happen to stop it. Madison and Jasper seemed stunned, and Carl's only concern was keeping Jasper from getting burned. I took off my muumuu, which was so easy to remove, by the way, and then I used it to cover my hands and gently lower the children to a squatting position on the ground. "Hey, Bessie, calm down now, okay?" She was rigid, and so was Roland, but the fire was just rolling across them, yellow and red, like what you'd draw with a limited supply of crayons. "Can you turn it off?" I asked, almost whispering, but they weren't listening. So then I started smothering the flames with the muumuu, which caused it to smolder and spark. I patted the children all over their arms, their backs, on top of their little heads. I went pat, 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 and kept whispering, "It's okay, it's okay, it's okay." I could feel the heat, but I just kept lightly tapping them, and the fire seemed to finally die out. As if they had been holding their breath the entire time, Bessie and Roland each took in a deep gulp of air and then sighed, suddenly sleepy. I leaned against them, and they kind of slumped onto me. And Carl finally ran over and scooped them both up, one in each arm, and put them back in the van, gently closing the doors.
And that's Kevin Wilson reading a section of his new novel, Nothing to See Here. Where does the image of children expressing their anger or their fear or their attempt to protect themselves as catching on fire? I mean, in a way, it's almost like a tantrum, and we all understand children's tantrums. We've either witnessed them or, you know, experienced them. But why this image of catching fire?
I mean, for me, it starts when I was a child. When I was probably 9 or 10 years old, I was obsessed with these commercials on TV for the Time Life Mysteries of the Unknown set of books, which you could order, and I wanted them so badly, but they were very expensive, and my parents were never going to order something over the phone. But I had a friend, my best friend, Tony Petrochko, had them, and I would go over to his house and read them, and I was obsessed with them, and there was this really small section, maybe even just a panel, on spontaneous human combustion. And the moment I saw it and understood that possibility, it just locked into my brain forever. I thought about it a lot. This kind of reoccurring image in my head of people bursting into flames. And I was an anxious kid, and I had all this agitation inside of me. And so it made sense that I just assumed I might burst into flames. It seemed entirely possible. And then, as I got older and became a teenager and my anxiety kind of became more understandable, I kind of wanted to burst into flames, you know, like that would burn out all the anxiety inside of me and I'd be kind of clean. So I just kind of wanted that. And so it just kind of repeated in my head over and over again until I decided I've got to write about it. And like you said, with knowing children, I have two little boys. And I think children, when they have tantrums or even when they're agitated, they look like they're going to combust. It's entirely possible to me that my boys might burst into flames.
I think my mother, when things would get out of hand and the kids or the cousins were getting too excited, she'd say, "They're getting overheated."
It's true. And even my son, Griff, who when he gets anxious, he feels it all in his ears as a heat. And he'll just dunk his head in water. And to me, I was like, yes, that makes perfect sense. That's what I would do, too.
Tell me what it said in about spontaneous combustion. Well, I mean, about human spontaneous combustion.
Yeah. I mean, the important thing about spontaneous human combustion is that you die, you know, and you burst into flames and the flame works on the fat in your body and you burn down. And a lot of times that's so self-contained that like even the chair that you're sitting in is kind of untouched. But that was not interesting to me. I didn't want to burst into flames and die. I wanted to burst into flames over and over again as many times as I needed to. So once I understood the mystery of it, I thought that's not mysterious enough. I want more than that. I need it to happen again and again.
We have the kind of opposite, like the children who burst into flames are not harmed by the flames, but people around them could be. They can burn the house down. They can burn a tree down.
Yeah, I mean, that's for me how agitation and anger and tantrums work. I mean, it may be affecting you internally, but it's the external world that it really affects, that it kind of disrupts.
So a question in the book is, like, where do these children get this crazy ability? Is it inherited? And if so, is it the mother or the father who passed on this, like, strange power? And I know that's been an issue for you, because you're concerned that you've passed on some of your problems to your oldest son. You were diagnosed as an adult with Tourette's syndrome.
Yeah, and, you know, I've always had this kind of agitation and looping thoughts and small tics. And finally, as an adult, a neurologist said, I think you might have Tourette's. And again, it wasn't how it was portrayed on TV or in books, so I didn't fully believe that, but I wanted to get better, so that's what I accepted.
Can we just interrupt here and say the way it's portrayed on TV is that you keep saying things that you ordinarily wouldn't say, and some of those things are very, like, insulting, and it shows what's going on in your brain that other people would censor, but you would just, like, shout it out. But that's not what you have.
Right. I mean, mine is so much more internal. Those images and looping tics are in my head, and so a lot of the work that I'm doing is just keeping it in there. You know, once I realized this, we were also thinking about having kids, and I knew we wanted them, but I also wasn't sure how to take care of them. And I knew one of the things I was worried about was genetically, what am I passing on to my children? What am I responsible for with them? And my boys, you know, they're 11 and 7, and Griff certainly has shown issues of anxiety, and that became a huge worry. But frankly, I think maybe I was a little self-important. Like, I thought, oh, you know, I'm going to ruin my children. But I think maybe my children won't let me ruin them. They're tougher and more stable than maybe I had imagined. They're incredible and wild and weird. But, you know, that initial worry, like, oh, God, when you have a kid, you just ruin them, starts to fall away as the children learn how to survive without you.
And have their own will that you can't necessarily shape.
Yeah, and then it becomes scary in a different way. Yeah. You're worried at first that they're too much like you, and then you realize that they're not you at all. And then that's terrifying, because then how are you going to keep them close to you?
Well, I read an article about you in which you were talking about how when your son was young, he wouldn't eat. And you were afraid, like, I mean, you need to eat to stay alive, and he just wouldn't eat. And he was obviously very afraid of something, but he wouldn't tell you what he was afraid of. Can you talk about what it was like to handle that?
Yeah, I mean, he, you know, Griff would have what he would say bad thoughts. You know, I'm having these kind of stressful, strange thoughts, which he didn't want to tell us about. And I understood that clearly because that's how my brain works, too. You know, my brain doesn't care if I want to think about it or not. It gives me what it gives me. And so those moments can be so stressful that you don't want to eat. You don't want to communicate. You want to move inside of yourself to protect yourself. And so when I saw that happening with Griff, I both understood it very clearly, but I also understood that whatever is inside of him is mysterious to me. It's not exactly the same, no matter how much I think it might be. But yeah, it was that initial worry that, oh, this is me. This is me all over again.
What were your fears when you were terrified as a kid but wouldn't tell anyone?
Yeah, I mean, they were mostly these kind of repeating images of doom, of danger, of and it wasn't always me, but falling off of tall buildings, getting stabbed, catching on fire. There were these just quick, kind of violent bursts in my head. And I have to say, like, my family is incredible. We were as close as we could be. I mean, like, every Friday night when we were teenagers, my sister and I would play canasta with my parents. We were just always with each other. But there was still this kind of hidden part of me that I didn't want to talk about because I was certain that once it kind of entered the open air, it would change everything.
How would it change everything?
Because if I said I have this darkness inside of me, it might kind of destroy the kind of wonderful life that we had all built together, that I would be the reason that it started to become complicated, you know, that my agitation would cause anxiety for them, you know. And of course, I think they easily could have handled it. They loved me and still love me. But when you're a kid, you're not certain, right? You don't know what's the tipping point. So I hit it.
My guest is Kevin Wilson. His new novel is called Nothing to See Here. We'll talk more after a break, and Kevin Whitehead will review a reissue of music performed by the late jazz pianist Errol Garner. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with writer Kevin Wilson. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan describes his 2011 novel, The Family Fang, as strange and wonderful. His new novel, Nothing to See Here, is about a 28-year-old woman who gets a job taking care of twin 10-year-olds with a bizarre disorder. When they are frightened or angry, they burst into flames. Family is the subject Wilson most often writes about. When he was a child, he was terrified by the alarming images that would loop around his brain. As an adult, he was diagnosed with Tourette's syndrome, which helped explain those alarming images. You said that you live in your head, and I'm wondering how the Tourette's affects your life as a writer and if it affects your need to write.
Yeah, I mean, I think from a young age, I always had narrative in my head. There were these images and ideas, and I loop a lot. And when I read or see things that I like, I tend to watch them again and again so that I can kind of memorize the sound of it and so that can kind of stay inside my head. And it wasn't until, like, college, really, that I realized, oh, these are narratives. These are stories. And there's a way that you know, part of the problem was they were in my head for so long that they started to repeat and get weirder and weirder. And there was a point where I thought, if I can just put this on paper, I have some control over it. And I thought, oh, it'll get rid of it. And it doesn't quite do that, but it allows me this way to kind of control and deal with those images. So writing is, I think, the thing that saved me, being able to transfer what was in my head onto the page. And then there's this freedom that once it hits the open air, once it goes out into the world and you publish it, you're kind of free of it for a little while, at least. It's somebody else's problem.
Like me, the reader?
Yeah, I'm inflicting these weird things on the reader so I don't have to deal with them.
Since you say that you live in your head, what do you do about the rest of your body? Like, do you work out? Do you care about the rest of your body?
I don't take good care of it, that's for sure. No, I like to walk. I like to walk with the kids. My son will put on an audiobook, and I'll put on an audiobook, and we walk side by side, and I can feel the closeness of him to me, and we just keep walking. We keep moving. And as we do that, we're listening to these narratives that can kind of take the place of whatever's in our head. And it's really calming and wonderful. But most of the time, I'm trying to make my space as small as possible. I'm trying to keep my body as tightly contained as it can be so that it's protected. So I don't like to leave the house. And I will, and I can do it. But the happiest is when it's just me and my family. And we're close enough that we sense each other as they are.
In the new novel, the father and stepmother of the children who catch on fire when they get upset, the children who spontaneously combust, the parents want to send them to boarding school. Like, let the professionals handle them. We can't deal with it. And that's especially true because, you know, the father is a senator who thinks he's about to be nominated to be Secretary of State. He's going to go through the vetting process. And the last thing he needs is, like, kids who set themselves on fire. This is a terrifying thought. And I think the whole idea to you of, like, sending children to be raised by professionals or having this utopian community where parents kind of share in the child raising is something you've thought about a lot.
Yeah.
Because it's reflected in other books that you've written, too. Did you have that fear, like, when you became a parent, like, I'm not going to do a good enough job? Is there a doctor? Is there a school? Is there, like, somebody who could do this right for me?
Yeah. I mean, I think after we had our first child, my wife, Leanne, who is gifted in every way that I'm not with children, she's so intuitive and so wonderful and doesn't worry in the same way that I do. But I remember my parents were watching Griff and we went out to dinner. It was a rare night to the two of us. And I said, I'm thinking about this new book. And it's I kind of had been thinking about, I just wish we could send our child to a place where professionals, experts would raise him, and he would get everything that he needed, and he would be the stronger, better person at the end of it. And Leanne said, well, what would we do the whole time that was happening? And I said, oh, right, okay. And I was like, maybe we could be there too. Maybe we could be a part of it, and we would learn as well. And there's something to my mind that even though I love isolation and I need it, small communities where we all make each other stronger is appealing to me in theory. This idea that if we all come together, some of that anxiety will be lessened because we're all working towards this common goal.
Can you describe the perfect world you tried to create in your novel, Perfect World?
Yeah, so
perfect
this doctor,
world. Yeah.
This Dr. Grind, he comes up with this idea that if he can get 10 families, 10 couples who are all about to have a child, and he can raise them, and they can all live together in this compound, it's a kind of scientific commune, everyone's working towards this goal, and none of the children know who their actual parent is. To them, all 19, because the main character is coming without a partner, all 19 of those adults are the children's parents. And so what would it be like if you had to pretend that your child in some ways was just one of your 10 children? And what would it be like to be a child and understand that you had not two parents but 19?
How does it go?
It doesn't go well at all. I mean, that's the thing. That's the kind of thing about community, right, is that we have the best intentions, but then we're human. And the minute our weirdnesses touch other weirdnesses, things get complicated. It'll never be anything other than messy.
How were you raised?
Wonderfully. I had the most wonderful parents you could ever ask for. They supported me in everything that I wanted to do. We lived a close, isolated life. My sister is younger than me by 4 years, but in many ways she protected me and took care of me and watched out for me. She's also incredibly capable. But I think the thing that really is that, you know, as I needed help and as my parents, you know, living in Winchester, Tennessee, like when I was in high school and I was like, I need help, they drove me an hour and a half to Nashville to see a therapist. You know, they knew that I needed something and they were going to help me figure that out. And sometimes I think what was necessary and why I survived my childhood was because even though I wanted to keep everything hidden, I also knew that whatever I said, my parents would accept it. They would figure out how to work with me. And they also were really wonderful because they loved art too. And they exposed us to weirdness. It was such an interesting, wonderful household to be in. They let us, like, I remember being 6 years old and listening to Richard Pryor albums.
They let me watch
Seinfeld when I was a kid. Eddie Murphy. They really loved humor and the cadence of humor. They appreciated it. And so a lot of times I think we liked to make each other laugh. We liked to come up with that weirdness that would kind of spark in the other person. And so it was just the four of us in our house, and we would tell stories. My parents, when I was very young, made with the Super 8 camera stop motion animated Star Wars movies with me. They were just game for anything. And when I told my dad, I remember I was mowing the grass and we were sitting on the bed of his truck, and I said, I think I want to be a writer. I was in college, and I said, I think I'm going to try to do this. And that's probably the worst thing you can tell your parents, is that you want to be a writer. And he was just like, yeah, this makes perfect sense. You should do it. There was never a moment that they hesitated when I wanted to kind of make something.
Was it helpful to see a lot of comics when you were young who had unusual thoughts or strange experiences or strange, you know, emotions that felt strange to them, and talking about it and making it funny? Did you find that reassuring?
Yeah. I mean, you could see that what they were doing was trying to figure out their obsessions and then how to make those understandable to an audience. And one of the easiest ways to make strangeness understandable is by humor, to my mind. That if you can make it approachable and understandable in that funny way, then you can hit them with the darkness as you move forward. So that's kind of what I learned from comedians. It's not something I'd ever want to do. It seems like the worst job in the world, but I always appreciated it. I loved the rhythm of how they built those narratives, how they would have those callbacks. It's virtuosic.
Can I ask what your parents did professionally?
Yeah, my dad sold insurance. My mom was a nurse until she had us, and then she raised us. My family was always our number one priority was always each other. We were around each other all the time.
Are your parents still alive?
They are. Yeah, they live in the same town that I do.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah.
And do they read your novels?
I know that my dad does. He was, when I first said I wanted to be a writer, I gave him some stories I had written, and they were weird, but he loved them, and he was so supportive, and he is the one, you know, that reads my work for sure. And I know my mom and my sister do too, but I think my dad is the one who seems most fully invested in it as a way to kind of understand me. And when he read this Nothing to See Here, he was like, this is my favorite, which meant something to me because he's read me since I was 17 years old. So I felt like if I could please him, then maybe I was onto something.
Well, Kevin Wilson, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Kevin Wilson's new novel is called Nothing to See Here. He teaches English and creative writing at Suwannee, the University of the South. The The late jazz pianist Errol Garner is the subject of a new series of CD reissues of albums he recorded for various labels between 1959 and 1973. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of his pick from the series so far.
Errol Garner, 1964, giving a big Hollywood buildup to I Found a Million Dollar Baby at the 5 and 10 Cent Store, a song from 1931. It's from his album A Night at the Movies, my favorite so far from the ongoing Octave Remastered series of Garner albums. They're being issued one a month through next June. As an album concept, Songs from the Movies is about as loose as it gets. This one's even looser, because some songs, like that last one, actually come from Broadway. A few selections are older than talking pictures, like 1913's You Made Me Love You, a vehicle for Al Jolson, who did it slower than Errol Garner does. Errol Garner is among the most charming and chipper jazz pianists. He's got that relentlessly bouncy beat, he gets a big brassy sound from piano, and he has a way of circling back to the tune during an improvisation. Those qualities and his old-timey repertoire here can make Garner sound like a throwback to 1920s novelty ragtimers. But he was a modernist as well. The German song Just a Gigolo was a favorite of Thelonious Monk. Errol Garner puts his own spin on it, tinkering with its timing his way. Garner Trio's buoyant beat was a three-way effort, with Eddie Calhoun's bass, Kelly Martin's drums, and Errol's left hand all in sync. But Garner's roaming right hand was the trio's free agent. His improvised line would step across that firm beat and slip into the cracks between accents. That line hovers over the rhythm the way his variations hover over a melody. This is Stella by Starlight. Of discussions about how music makes you feel, because the same performance may evoke a wide range of reactions from different listeners. But it's hard to miss the joy that radiates from Errol Garner's piano as he spins out new and old melodies and cracks his little musical jokes. He's as listener-friendly as jazz gets. He improvises with wit, style, and grace, and he swings like mad. That joy he radiated is still contagious. You could catch it even now.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and The Audio Beat. He reviewed Night at the Movies, the first in a series of reissues of recordings by pianist Errol Garner. Coming up, we hear from actor Willem Dafoe. He's currently starring in Motherless Brooklyn, a film noir adapted from a Jonathan Lethem novel, directed by its star, Edward Norton. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, actor Willem Dafoe, is known for his intense performances, often as villains. Dafoe has appeared in more than 100 films over the past four decades, earning four Oscar nominations for Best Supporting Actor. Among his films are Platoon, To Live and Die in L.A., The Last Temptation of Christ, Grand Budapest Hotel, The Florida Project, and At Eternity's Gate, in which he portrayed Vincent van Gogh. He's currently starring in Motherless Brooklyn, written and directed by the film's star, Edward Norton. Dafoe spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies, and they began with a clip from Motherless Brooklyn. It's a film noir set in the 50s involving corruption in New York City land redevelopment. Edward Norton plays a private eye who has Tourette's syndrome. He's investigating this corruption because the people behind it seem connected to the murder of the head of the detective agency where he works. The person behind the redevelopment plans is a ruthless power broker named Moses Randolph, who's clearly based on the real-life figure of Robert Moses. Dafoe's character, Paul, is one of the people opposing the redevelopment plan because he and just about everyone else in his neighborhood will be forced out of their homes by the new construction. In this scene, Dafoe is in a diner, talking with Norton's character, who's posing as a reporter to get people to reveal information. Dafoe's character, Paul, speaks first to the waiter at the diner.
Hey, excuse me, could I get a slice of cheesecake? Couldn't you make it one? I'd like it one. Half of the city is getting a ride on one of his horses. For God's sakes, he controls every construction job in the city.
You said they just created the position.
No, construction, slums, parks. He's got 14 appointments. It's all just ink on a glass door. None of it matters. It's all B.A.
B.A.?
Borough Authority. You call yourself a reporter on what? The arts beat?
Beat what?
You read Emerson?
Should I?
Yeah, you should.
All right.
Emerson said that an institution is the length and shadow of one man. This town is run by the Borough Authority, and the Borough Authority is Moses Randolph.
And that is our guest, Willem Dafoe, in Motherless Brooklyn. Well, Willem Dafoe, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I noticed that your character begins by asking for cheesecake served warm.
Right.
Bit of a character, right? Bit of an oddball.
Yes, yes.
We first meet him when he's kind of shouting out stuff at Moses Randolph in a meeting. Tell us how you saw this character.
One of the beauties of this character is he's not as he appears. When you first see him, you think maybe is a homeless guy, unstable, with an axe to grind, paranoid. And then you learn he really holds the secrets that he knows intimately about corruption in the city. Because Moses Randolph is his brother. and there's almost a Shakespearean backstory to how they both arrived to where they are when we see them in the movie. And they basically started out, brothers, wealthy family, with a deep sense of noblesse oblige that they wanted to help make the world a better place. But then there's a real split because my brother, all of a sudden, as I say in the story, I say he gets tired of losing to lesser minds, and he gets frustrated and becomes obsessed with accumulating power and winning, if that has any resonance, you know, in this day and age, that word winning, and they have a split. But at the same time, this isn't a strict, you know, polemic. I mean, really, the Moses Randolph character, beautifully played by Alec Baldwin, also expresses some interesting things. He talks about, he uses Central Park as an example, that there was resistance to Central Park when they wanted to create a private park. They displaced some farmers. They moved some trees. He says that people have to be forward-thinking, and sometimes it's the men of action that, you know, must make progress. But, of course, there's great corruption in the story, and in right. the name of progress, a lot of people are just considered collateral damage, and that's accepted.
I wanted to talk about the Florida Project, which
sure.
you earned an Oscar nomination for your role in. This is a really interesting film from director Sean Baker about kids, like young kids, like 6-7-year-olds who live with their parents in some cheesy motels near Disney World in Florida. And they kind of have this world of these tacky souvenir shops and ice cream stands and run around. And their parents are, you know, they're struggling. They're living in a motel, not always making the best decisions, but trying to make it work. This was actually filmed in a working motel, right? This was not a set.
Well, the story was really the people that were living that life where we filmed. Sean hung out there and really took on that world, was embedded in that world. And the people that were there really showed us how to tell our story, kept us from, you know, romanticizing it or
You're saying the people who actually lived in this hotel, the Magic Castle?
Oh, yeah, because we were mixing people that lived there with first-time actors, with non-actors, with actors. What dictated what we did was what was there, and we took our cues from that. I mean, the interesting thing for me was that I'm always interested in not being an actor that doesn't seem like an actor. And I'm not just talking about naturalism. I'm talking about you want to melt into the fabric of the world. And we took our cues from the people that lived there. I didn't perform a manager as much as I did the duties of a manager, and that was the way into the character, because that was practical. And I've always felt like, you know, you don't think characters are revealed through the action, and if it's the quality of how you commit to the actions, how you commit to what these people do, that reveals who they are. So my job was really to be the best manager of a hotel I could be, and that's what I did in the movie.
And did you hang out there and do the things that a motel manager does? I mean, you know.
That's all I did. That's all I did. That's
turn on the
that's
breaker
the movie
box
for me.
And paint.
Oh,
and,
yeah. I didn't live there. But I had my room there, and, you know, you'd be there pretty much all day.
Right. And I want to play a clip here, because your character, Bobby, is, you know, he's not just a guy who checks people in and out. He's kind of the mayor of this little community in a way. You're
right.
looking out
right.
for people. And in this case, this scene begins where you notice that the kids are playing in a park nearby with some picnic benches, and you notice an older man in shorts walk up and engage the kids. And
right.
you suspect he's a predator, and you intervene. I'll note, as the scene progresses, we're going to hear you knock a soda out of this guy's hand and then kind of grab him so you can muscle his wallet away and get his driver's license to ID him. But it begins with you approaching this man who's trying to engage the kids. Let's listen.
Excuse me, can I help you?
No, that's okay.
What's okay? Mooney, get off that picnic table. People eat on that thing. Come on, girl. You're a guest here?
No, I'm looking for a soda machine.
You come to a motel to get a soda?
It's okay.
Come on. Come with me.
I know
where there's a soda machine.
No,
just
no.
Come with me. You want a soda, right?
Yeah. I came here. I was passing by on the high.
Get
on
off
the road.
That picnic table.
Yeah. I was just passing by.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get a soda because I need
you're
a soda.
You're parched, huh?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. You wanted to wet that palate, right?
Yeah.
No. It's right up here. Just a little more ways. You came for a soda. We're going to get your soda, right? What a choice.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, I thought you were thirsty.
Yeah.
Aren't you going to drink it now?
Yes.
Good?
Sure.
You come on this property again and you won't be leaving it, you understand?
I don't know what you're talking about.
You don't know what I'm talking about? You're going to play it that way, huh?
Hey.
All right. Charlie Coachman of Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
You can't kick me out. That's my license.
I'm going to call your name into the county sheriff. Now you get the out of
here.
And that is our guest Willem Dafoe in the film The Florida Project with Carl Bradford as your co-actor there. He was not an actor, right?
I think he's been in some movies. He's a retired, Army veteran.
Mm-hmm. How is your role different when you're dealing with folks who kind of don't know the conventions of acting?
Sean Baker made them very comfortable, made a world that they could live in. And there wasn't a lot of pressure to perform, I'd say, for them. So they were very relaxed and living a life. And there's a sort of truth and clarity and practicality to what they're doing. They aren't swinging for the fences. They're not trying to deliver a big performance. The kids are just having fun. And the adults are just trying to make the scenes make sense to them. So there's a practicality to it that's beautiful. And you hop on that and you kind of get over yourself and you leave that actor ego behind and you try to contribute to that world and be in that world.
You grew up in Wisconsin in a really big family, right? Dad was a doctor,
right.
Mom was a nurse.
Yep.
You went to the University of Wisconsin.
Briefly.
Made your way to New York and co-founded an experimental theater called the Wooster Group, which ended up being something you were involved in for decades, right?
Right, for like 27 years. And to be fair, I didn't actually co-found.
Okay.
It really existed. It grew out of a company called the Performance Group. So technically speaking, I'm not a founder, but I'm one of the earliest members.
How did you get from theater to film?
I think the most significant thing was people would see me at the theater initially because I didn't have a manager, I didn't have an agent. And it was a downtown avant-garde theater, so it didn't have the same kind of aspirations and ambitions that most, actors working off-Broadway or off-Broadway had. It defied that categorization. It was a thing by itself. It was a community theater for that community, but the community happened to be Soho and the East Village in a time that there was a lot of cross-fertilization and a lot of great music invention, a lot of independent film, a lot of new dance and theater. So it was a very fertile time.
You got into a film, I guess, around 1980, and it seems like it went quite well. By 1985, you have a leading role in To Live and Die in L.A., which was a great action film. And, all actors, besides the skill they bring their physical characteristics, their build, their ethnicity, their face. You have a distinct face, I think, a lot of people say. I'm wondering, as you started doing auditions, how did you think you were perceived? For what kind of roles did you fit in?
Well, it was clear, it's when you do something, people respond to it, they want you to do it again. So then they attribute the attributes of your character to you. So I played a lot of kind of dark characters, kind of villainous characters. So in the beginning, I guess I was very conscious that they were casting me as villains. You know, he's a good bad guy. And I found that fun for a little while, but then I was on guard and, didn't want to be required to go to the same well all the time. I wanted, not that versatility is, the end all to acting, but I just felt like it was a little restrictive. There are beautiful villain roles, but some of them are written very shallowly and are just really devices for the most interesting parts of the story to happen.
Right. Well, in 86, you did Platoon. That earned you your first Oscar nomination. And I gather probably opened up a lot of other roles for you, didn't it?
It did, but the irony was, I remember this very well. It was a period of, a lot of people making proposals to me, but whether it was timing or whatever, or I just didn't find the right project for almost a year. So you get attention because you're lifted out of the pack for a moment, because when you do get a nomination, it shines a light on you, particularly if you're not well known. So it was a big leap in, career-wise, I suppose. But it was funny that I couldn't find the right piece to do for like a year. And then finally, when I did find something, a very interesting script with a new director, it was a Vietnam thing, like the worst, talk about repeating yourself. Mm-hmm. On paper, it was a terrible thing to follow up Platoon with. But very different kind of movie, but it was a film called Off Limits, and it was a studio film at Fox. And that was the next thing I did. And it was very difficult because I think it, without judging the movie, because some people really love that movie, it wasn't a big success, I don't think. And it came in under one regime, and the next regime really wanted to kill it. So it was my first experience of being in a studio film where there were some studio politics at play. So the director was always fighting with production, and it was a difficult time. And that was the follow-up to this beautiful experience of Platoon. There were pleasures in it, but it was tough. And then I thought, wow, I got to rethink this. So I went back, as I always did, went back to the theater and thought, well, I better dig in here. I don't know about this film stuff. And then I was teaching in with the company, doing workshops at a university in Massachusetts. And it was summertime, and I was staying at a very modest bed and breakfast. And I got a call one day. Martin Scorsese wants to see you.
Oh.
And I said, cool. What about? And they said, well, this Last Temptation of Christ, which I had heard about, but I had never gone in on. Everybody and their mother went in on this movie, but not me. And I thought, really, what role? And my agent says, idiot, Jesus. So...
Well, if you want to break out of playing villains, I guess that's going yeah, to the other end, isn't it?
It is. It is. And I thought it was strange. I thought, really? And then I read the script, and it made sense to me because the nature of how the story is told and an exploration of the human part of this divine character. So, I hopped on board, and that kind of slapped me out of the
doldrums there, yeah.
The doldrums, yeah.
Willem Dafoe, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Willem Dafoe spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Dafoe is currently starring in Motherless Brooklyn. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.